Judging from such a wonderful turnout, I'm just going to take a wild guess that maybe you've heard of him before. I'd like to reacquaint you with just a few of Ambassador Keyes' credentials. Ambassador Alan Keyes, as many of you will remember, was a candidate for the 1996 Republican presidential nomination. He's the founder and the chairman of the Board of Declaration Foundation. He is an author and a public speaker, thank God, on a wide range of national and foreign policy issues. He's an educator, a writer of a weekly distributed newspaper column on current affairs, and he is the host of a nationally syndicated talk show entitled The Alan Keyes Show, America's Wake-Up Call. During Ronald Reagan's presidency from 1981 to 1987, Dr. Keyes was the United States Ambassador to the United Nations Economic and Social Council, and later he served as Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations. Many of you will remember and know that he has been featured on Dr. James Dobson's Focus on the Family radio broadcasts. He has appeared in all the major media outlets, ABC's Nightline, NBC's Today Show, CBS's Morning News, the McNeil-Lehrer Report, and CNN's Larry King Live. Whether or not you have heard Dr. Keyes in person before, or whether you've heard him via one of these media outlets, you are in stall for an informative and an inspirational talk this evening. Dr. Keyes is eloquent. He is passionate. He is passionately pro-life. He is principled. He's a husband, and he's the father of three. Most importantly, he draws his strength from our Lord and is deeply convicted of God. Won't you help me welcome Dr. Alan Keyes?
Thank you very much. Praise God. Thank you.
Good evening. I want to add my word of praise for that wonderful, wonderful music. I think we can truly say that we witnessed a musical performance where the singing was done with authority tonight. Leave aside the bad jokes. When I walked through the door and saw the peacemakers in uniform, I sort of was wondering whether the IFI meant to be prepared. The last time I had police officers approach me that way, it was in Atlanta. It wasn't altogether pleasant. But thankfully, they were singing a different song tonight. I must appreciate that. Good evening. I wish I could say that I was going to stand before you here this evening and generally, actually, I don't wish I could say this, but it might be expected that I generally share the expectation of, I don't know, discouragement and downheartedness. I am, after all, along with Mike Pence and some other people, a Christian conservative Republican, in that order. But because of the order, I have to tell you that when I woke up on the Wednesday morning after these last midterms, oh, I don't know. I think I felt more energized than I have in a long time. Now, why is that? You would think, I mean, the Republican part of me should have been unhappy, right? I mean, after all, the Republicans didn't do as well as they expected. But come on, let's share a small secret here. In the last 2 years, we can hardly name a single point of principle or policy on which the Republican Congress did not compromise, abandon, and desert the truth. I've got to tell you. And therefore, what would it have been like if we'd awakened on Wednesday morning, they had they had gained 25 seats in the House of Representatives, came forward to announce that, you see, we told you the Clintonization of the world was successful, we shall continue it. Could you have? I couldn't have stood that result. So, all right. What happened, I think, on that Tuesday was that admittedly, the day before I was kind of praying America would get what it needed, because I'll explain in a minute what we needed. Instead, God in his wisdom decided that we should get what the Republicans deserved. And I'm kind of glad. I love it when the truth comes out. Do you love it when the truth comes out? And on Tuesday, the truth came out. And the truth is very simple. You stand before people and you say that we are for moral principle and strengthening families and returning power and money to the people. And then you spend years doing business as usual with one of the most corrupt and reprehensible presidents in the history of the country. Don't expect a reward. It also serves a useful purpose. I was thinking about it today during the course of the presentation on the IFI. Because in recent years, it has become quite popular to stand before all kinds of audiences and declare your strong belief in family and family values and the moral issues and so forth and so on. Several years ago, when I started carrying that standard in the late unlamented presidential election, you remember that, I didn't find the platform crowded with other people saying the same thing. As a matter of fact, there was almost nobody there. And I would go to the various gatherings, and all the other candidates would kind of look at me like I was crazy. I gained the nom de plume of preacher, the preachers here. And though I am not a preacher, I have to say, I wore it with pride. I don't see why not. But the object there was kind of ridicule. You know, you belong in the pulpit, not on a public platform. We don't want that kind of stuff in here. This is about politics. That was the attitude. Now I find several things are true. In the course of the last several years, that attitude seems to have changed. There's been some attitude adjustment. And now, as I go around the country speaking to audiences, I don't find a whole lot of skepticism about the notion that the country's in a deep moral crisis that threatens it with destruction. I don't know why. But it just seems like people understand that now a little better than they did a few years ago. With the result, of course, you have all kinds of politicians parading up. They were making statements about this and that and going before the Christian coalition, making fine speeches and changes of heart. They never explained these changes of heart, of course. Some of them would go forward and say, you know, they had been pro-abortion, and now they stand up saying all kinds of speeches about how they're pro-life, never explaining how or why they changed their minds. But that's because they changed their minds based on what their consultants and pollsters had told them was going to be profitable, politically. And then along comes the election on Tuesday. And all of a sudden, you've got everybody saying, you see that moral stuff, that'll kill you politically. And it was even true that some people I dearly respect and like, including Governor Bob James in Alabama, folks who were good, strong soldiers of the truth in their state, went down for various reasons. He was the victim of a lot of gambling money coming into the state, and others thought, went by the wayside. So you did get kind of the impression, and you'll certainly get it from the news media, that it was dangerous to your political health to be four square for God's moral truth, especially if along with that you mentioned his name from time to time on the public platform. Now, why would it be that in spite of the fact that I liked and respected some of the folks who were defeated, that I actually think it might be a good thing what happened to them? That I kind of don't think of them as losses, but more as kind of martyrs, to the political martyrs to the truth? I think of it because when you come to a time when it may be that for a minute in the political arena, it is popular to try to exploit the moral constituency, and when a lot of folks are coming forward to pretend they care, I think it's God's mercy and providence and wisdom to send through a storm that will particularly take out a few of the folks prominently identified with his position. And then as they fall and everybody's making the argument about how dangerous it is to stand with God, we might just get a notion of who's serious and who's not.
The people you see heading for the hills right now are the folks you shouldn't have believed anyway, shouldn't have trusted, and shouldn't have accepted anyhow. And it's a good thing we know who they are. And we're beginning to see a lot of folks whose names were writ large coming forward now to tell us how you've got to forget those moral issues. You've got to put them on the back burner. They're dangerous. We've got to broaden the base to all these people who don't care about it. And y'all, especially folks at the IFI, there are some seats in the back of the bus for you. Please get back in them where you belong. And we're hearing it from all kinds of quarters, including some of the folks who are now competing for the leadership positions in the Congress. I'm not going to go into that in great detail, but please don't have too much in the way of expectation from the next couple of years. What we ought to be doing, I think, is praying to God sincerely that they will do nothing in the Congress for the next 2 years. No, really. Because, I mean, the simple truth is that the Republicans had a slim working majority when they went into the election. When they came out on the other side, they had lost their working majority. They have a numerical majority. They do not have a working majority. And there's a difference in legislative life. And what that means is that the margin of difference is too slim now, and in the Republican conference, all they've got to do is hive off 5 or 6 people, and the bad stuff gets through. And as a result, the leadership's going to have 2 choices. They can either try to push good things and let those moderates desert over to the Democrats where they write really awful bills and pass them through, or they themselves can go in the back room and make really bad compromises with the Democrats and pass that junk through. Neither of those things strikes me as very good. Therefore, it would be better if they did nothing. Pray to God that they do nothing. It'll be much better for all of us. You notice that even in the course of the last couple of years, they were so interested in governing that they unfortunately succeeded at doing things. And I would have much preferred that they had spent time passing things other than rancid pork barrel appropriation bills that ratified the notion that business as usual is all we get, even with a Republican majority. So I thought that the election was sobering, but it was also a warning. And for those of us who really care deeply about this nation's future and who understand the critical importance of returning to the right moral path and principle, the election was, I think, a gift from God, and it will set up a time of discernment when we will be able a little more clearly, I hope, to see who's true and who's not, to see who's sincere and who's phony. And sad to say, I think we're seeing that, too, with respect to the issue that now is front and center for the Republicans, also for the Democrats, but more so for the leadership in the Congress, that I want to talk about for a minute today because it's a good introduction to what I think needs to be our thinking tonight. And it probably won't surprise you to learn that I am one of those people who thinks that Bill Clinton ought to be impeached. This probably comes as no shock to you. No, wait. Wait now. I actually thought that before the Lewinsky business. I kind of think... I don't know. It vaguely upset me when it looked like he was getting money from the communist Chinese to betray our national security. Maybe a little quirk of mine, but I think that selling us out to potential enemies is significant. But and then the Lewinsky thing comes along as kind of maybe even a distraction, playing on the possibility, which at the time was only a possibility, that the American people would be quite willing to ignore something that involved sex on the grounds that, hey, that's nobody's business, you can do whatever you please. And sadly speaking, it looks like that's the direction we're headed in, whether a true reflection of the American heart or not, I am not sure. I know it's a reflection of the fact that among their other sins, the Republican leaders totally neglected to make the simple, clear, easy case as to why this is an important matter and leave aside all the other grounds on which you might question this administration's integrity and loyalty and everything else. I will take on the case, and I'll especially do it here tonight, and I think we have to do it, that if this were about nothing else and it were only about whether or not in the Oval Office, in the White House, the President of the United States had engaged in an extramarital affair with a government employee, and if he had stood up in front of us and told the absolute truth about the whole thing, we should still kick him out. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. We have all these folks standing up here parading in front of the American people. We care about families. We want stronger families. Family is the foundation stone. Family is important. You hear it all over the place. What is the foundation of decent family life? If I go up to that altar and I stand in front of it and I take a vow that I am going to love, honor, obey, and be faithful, and then after years of marriage, I corrupt that vow and systematically, in every possible way, turn my back on it persistently and consistently. That's bad enough. But if I have begged for the most visible office in the United States, if I am standing on a platform before this entire people, where every child in this nation will know and understand the scandal of my behavior, then that behavior in and of itself is a direct assault on the fundamental foundations of family life. It cannot be tolerated. There is no way anybody, and I say this with some point this evening, because sad to say, some of you know that I'm known for being probably more outspoken than I ought to be. And so I may give a little offense this evening. I will apologize in advance. But anybody who stands before us now and says that it's not important for the Congress of the United States to walk with strict integrity in dealing with the impeachment issue and to vote come what may, in a way that sends the clear message to our posterity that this business cannot be tolerated. Anybody who says this, in my considered opinion, should be kicked out of office. Now, the reason I forewarned you for a minute there is because I don't generally do this, but tonight I just feel moved to do this. I had heard in the last few days, just before I got here, and I was thinking, I'm going to Indiana. I'm going to have to mention this to folks. And I was reminded of it this evening because there, right in the video, I was unfortunately reminded of the fact that if you really believe what I just said, do any of you know or care about Mark Souder? You know him? He's a congressman? Well, I think you better call him. Because the media is now playing him up as one of those Republicans who wants the Republicans to drop the impeachment issue. And I'll tell you, I have said it on the radio and I'll say it here. I'm going to declare a personal Alan Keyes political war against all Republicans who support the idea that we should let this lying adulterer off the hook. And I'm going to do it. We have an obligation. We either mean what we say when we stand before the American people and we don't. Push has come to shove now. And we're going to have to stand before the people and we're going to have to show that we don't do these things just for politics. That this is not some game that we're playing to see who gets elected and who doesn't. Because that's not what's at stake. What's at stake right now in our judgment about this important issue is whether or not we're going to tolerate the utter corruption of that heart and conscience which is necessary to sustain decent family life. Whether we're going to tolerate before our children the notion that lies don't count if they're about sexual responsibility. In point of fact, when you think about it, those are among the most dangerous lies that can be told. They are among the lies that corrupt the heart. They are among the lies that destroy the bonds of trust and obligation without which family cannot survive. And that fact alone in a president of the United States is sufficient to require that he be removed from office. He's unfit for the place he holds. But that's not it. That's not alone. We have, in addition to that, the fact that he covered up his wrongdoing, understanding, see, this is a confession, that he lied about it was understanding what a really significant wrong it was. He didn't act like it wasn't significantly wrong, or he would have just strutted out there all bold and said, yeah, I did it, so what? Notice he didn't do that. Matter of fact, he shook his finger in our face and said that he'd never slept with this one or that one. All right. He understood that this was a grave offense. He understood it because he had spent all his time running up and down the country during the election telling us how important integrity was. Isn't it funny how that's now dropped out as part of the job description? I don't know. But he understood it. It was very important, so he lied about it. And in the course of lying about it, we need to remember who he is. Who is the individual who puts his hand on that Bible, takes the oath to be president? Read the Constitution. A lot of people don't realize that the president's role is different than that of the Supreme Court or the Congress. If somebody gets elected to the Congress of the United States, they are a member of Congress. If somebody gets chosen for and confirmed as a justice on the Supreme Court, they are a member of the court. When you are elected as president of the United States, you are the executive power. You are not a member of that power. You're not a part of that power. You don't enter into an office. The Constitution says that the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. There is no separate office and all this stuff people talk about. When the president lies, it is the executive branch that has lied. When the president commits perjury, it is the executive branch that has assaulted the judicial branch and undermined the very foundation of its integrity. And all of these folks who are coming for us now say, oh, this is private business. This is none of our business so far. It's very strange. I don't know. I have in recent weeks begun to wonder whether or not in some collective sense it is possible for masses of people in a nation to entirely lose their minds. Do you think? I mean, now tell me. I read in an article the other day about a superintendent of schools who had taken an order of plumbing supplies that had been purchased for the school district and diverted them for use in a home that he was building for himself. And this was considered to be a matter of grave public concern, and he was being called to account for it, and he was going to be tried and thrown in jail. That's because, generally speaking, when a government official takes property that has been paid for by the taxpayer and uses it for his private purposes, this is understood to be grave malfeasance in office. So if I get the plumbing fixtures, put them in my house, that's all right. But if in the Oval Office I abuse and disgrace the White House, that's my private business? I don't see how we get from there to here. Do you? Not only is it true that it's a revered place and all that, but who pays the rent at the White House? Who? We do! And it's our money that... See, every time I say that, I have to stop, though, because... Because in point of fact, it's not our money at all, or it's not only our money. As we just recently did, we will go to the battlefields and cemeteries, and we will look at the rows of white crosses that mark our honored dead. And will we then forget that house was paid for with their blood? Will we forget that house was paid for with the sacrifices and sweat, the life and death of generations of Americans? When you take that oath of office, you don't own that house because we own it and they own it, and it will always be a part of a heritage that no president can claim, but that a president such as this can certainly destroy. And so how are we forgetting ourselves? How can this be his private business? What he does, not just with our house, but with the house that belongs to all these generations of our people. Leave aside, of course, the fact that this was also a government employee, right? Now, is there a line item in the budget that I missed for kind of sex toys for the president? I don't remember that. course, the way the budgeting process is going now, they probably slipped it in one of these conferences in the middle of the night, but I don't think so. So how can we, even at that superficial level, want to pretend that this is private business? Oh, took the oath of office, said he was going to be president 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There isn't a time where the alarm goes off in the White House and everybody can come in and say, "Hi, Bill." Oh, even his friends still have to walk into the Oval Office and say, "Mr. President." Why is that? Because it's 24/7. Because at every moment and at any moment, he has to be and is called upon to exercise that power which is in his person, not in his office, which goes with him where he goes, and which is therefore corrupted by his personal actions if he is corrupt. And that has an immediate effect on the world, too, because he is, after all, commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Periodically, it seems almost every fall now, we are reminded of this by another pseudo-crisis generated by the White House, as the recent one was. I think the only crisis that we're actually going through at the moment is the crisis of a gutless president with no values or shame, but nobody wants to see that. I think that is far, by the way, I have to tell you, I think that's far more threatening to our national security than some tin pot dictator halfway around the world is going to be yet. But so we see the crisis. But what happens in this crisis? Our military people are involved, our forces go out and so forth and so on. Of course, it seems that with some presidents, we either send them out there and they spin their wheels in the Persian Gulf for months, and after everything has rusted, we send them in and they get all defeated. Or we have another president who decides in the middle of the night to send them. They get halfway there and he calls them back because he can't make up his mind. I don't know which is worse, but who are we using and abusing there? Our military forces. He's the commander-in-chief. Over the course of the last several years in the military ranks, we have seen numerous examples of people who were, in fact, cashiered from the military for the very offense that the president has committed, not just this extramarital relationship, but lying about it. And I think that they're deeply resentful right now. As a matter of fact, I know it, because at the risk of career and everything else, several of them have come forward to practically beg us, please impeach this guy, we can't respect him. And you think they're making a plea on our behalf? No, they're not. They're making a plea on behalf of this country's national security. They're making a plea on behalf of our survival in freedom. Because if the people who carry the weapons don't respect us anymore, don't expect liberty to survive. What has happened to us? Respect for civilian authority is a bedrock in any republic's existence. When your military people lose respect for civilian authority, you are in serious trouble. And the rule, therefore, is don't risk it. Now you'll say, but is there a professional responsibility? Be serious about this. How many of you are willing over a prolonged period of time to respect someone who's not respected, to give honor to that which denies your code of honor, the one by which you live or die in peace and war? How many? We wouldn't stand for it, and neither will they. It is not part of human nature, and we will strain it to the limit if we put unfit characters in the presidency and then demand that people whom we say must serve with honor, integrity, and conscience take orders from those who are not worthy to lick their boots. This won't work. So I just had to get this off my chest. And I was quite serious, though. I mean, I don't know if you'll respond, but I sincerely hope that you will do the nation a favor and that you will call your representative from here in Indiana and tell him that with respect to impeachment, it would be real good if he observed the old rule about the dead. If he can't say something good, he should say nothing. Because what he is saying right now is harmful to the country and destroys my opinion of any good he may say he is willing to do. Because this is the kind of thing that overrides everything. We go wrong on this one, and future generations will be deeply damaged. Our republic may very well be destroyed. Why do I say this? I say this because I've been on these shows with these people defending this whole mess, looking the camera in the eye, and telling us, as the Democrats now, I'm sorry to say, seem to want us to believe, that presidents are above the law. That's right. Alan Dershowitz on Hardball with me looked the camera right in the eye and said, presidents are above the law. The Constitution says presidents can commit certain crimes, except treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. No, he said this. And not only did he say it, Arlen Specter goes in the newspaper in the New York Times, writes a piece that amounts to saying the same thing. This Dershowitz argument was, you can't touch them while they're in there, wait till they get out. Then you can go for it. You can indict them and so forth. See, the president can be held accountable after he leaves office. I was about to say I mean no disrespect to Arlen Specter, but I can't say what I'm about to say without seeming a little disrespectful. I read that argument, and then I listened to an interview that he did, and I wondered about several things. The first thing I wondered about was whether or not this man, who, in spite of my deep differences of principle with him, I have always thought to be reasonably intelligent, had in fact suffered an accident or something. Because, no, seriously, think about it, my friends. He's saying that you let the presidents commit crimes while they're in office, and then afterwards you take care of it and indict them and try them. Let's look at the present situation just for a minute. What is Bill Clinton accused of in terms of criminal behavior? He is accused of perjury. And that perjury was committed in order to cover up his wrongdoing. Isn't that right? Now, I know that this is really difficult to get, but if you're looking at a situation where a president has committed a crime in order to cover up his wrongdoing, mightn't it occur to you that if you give presidents the license to commit crimes, among the crimes they commit will be the crimes needed to cover up their crimes? I would think this might just occur to you, but it apparently didn't occur to Arlen Specter or to Alan Dershowitz or any of these other fools. It ought to occur to us. We cannot give to any government official the license to commit crimes while they're in office, because among the crimes they commit will be the crime of silencing the witnesses, murdering the opposition, destroying the evidence. That's exactly what's going on. And so, for all these reasons, assault on the family, assault on the Constitution, and the acceptance of a doctrine that would place our elected officials above the law and leave us in a position of abject danger, insecurity, and ultimate slavery, for all these reasons, we better take this impeachment crisis seriously. And those who don't on either side should be held accountable. And in particular, Republicans who at this moment stand up and say we should drop the ball should be held particularly accountable. And we've got to be clear about this. So I don't do this very often, but I sincerely hope. Pick up the phone, call Souder's office, tell him to back off. I've called his office to see he'll come on my program. I bet he won't. But maybe he'll listen to folks from Indiana. This is very dangerous, and y'all can help. This is very dangerous. And it must be stopped. If they drop the ball on this, our republic may not survive in terms of its principles long enough for the IFI to save it. Now, that's true. Another point, though, in looking at this whole Clinton mess, and the reason why I'm harping on it so much everywhere I go now, and it obviously has nothing to do. I don't know whether Bill Clinton could be removed or not. I just know we've got to make a point that this kind of abuse of the office and the dignity of the country and the trust of the people is intolerable. But I also think it for other reasons. I looked into the Star report, and I do have to tell you that there's been this debate about whether or not it was pornographic and all this stuff. I don't think we should blame Kenneth Starr if it was. I think at the end of the day, the people who produce and act in these spectacles are probably more to blame than the people who investigate and uncover their wrongdoing. But if you see what I mean. But I still wouldn't necessarily recommend that you read it, because it's not really necessary. If you live in the neighborhood of a garbage dump, you probably have walked by occasionally, and when the wind's blowing in the right direction, you'll pick up a good, strong whiff of what's inside. How many of you are tempted to run in and take a look? No. See? Didn't think so. See, so believe me, and I have taken a look, the stench is correct. There's garbage there. And what we should really be praying for, I think, is that Congress will wake up soon and realize that in this particular case, the Constitution makes them our sanitation engineers. But I did learn something. There was a point in there in Lewinsky's testimony where after several of these, what shall we call them? I don't know exactly. I suppose given that it was in the Oval Office, we should call them appointments or consultations. After their first consultations, it apparently was the case that, contrary to the usual practice in consultations with the president, hardly a word had passed between them. And finally, she was led to ask this individual, "Don't you want to know me as a person?" I think that in that sad, pathetic little question is summarized the true evil at the heart of this whole mess. But what do we find in it? We find an indication of the truth that these are two people who are not approaching each other as human beings, but instead who are simply using one another as if they are things. And that sense of approaching another person and not seeing there an individual of worth and intrinsic dignity, but instead seeing merely an instrument of passion, of lust, of profit, of greed, to be exploited, used, abused, and then thrown aside. That attitude which drains from other human beings their God-given worth and significance may very well be at the heart of just about all the inhumanity that human beings do to one another. And we see it right there in the heart of this darkness in our White House. But if we understand the significance of it, then we'll realize something. The contrary to what's being told us, this isn't about some sex scandal or some relationship or anything like that. Because if it's that attitude which deprives the human person of worth and significance, that is in fact at the heart of this scandalous abuse of our trust and our institutions, then we know that in this administration, that attitude didn't begin with some flirtation, with some adulterous affair. It began the day before this man took office, when he signed away the Reagan year protections for the life of the innocent unborn children in the womb. And it was in evidence when he lifted his veto pen and banned the partial birth abortion bill, and thereby let infanticide continue in this country. It was the same heart. It was the same evil. It was the same attitude. And it is that which is the great danger that we face. But if this is true, then suddenly we are no longer justified in acting as if this is the crisis of one man or even one instance. For that evil was enshrined in our nation's life, not by Bill Clinton's attitudes, not by Bill Clinton's wrongdoing, not by Bill Clinton's veto. It was enshrined long before, when the Supreme Court inscribed in this nation's consciousness the lie that women have the right to take the lives of their innocent children in the womb. And we're all wondering, how can it be that we don't understand? How can it be that we're so easy? How can it be that we're ready to turn our backs and forget this? How can it be that we will sit still while folks present arguments that in the past would have scalded the ears of this free people? Arguments that are fit only for slaves, telling us that our leaders get to commit whatever crimes they like and cannot be called to account, and that what they do with our house, our treasure, our sacrifices is none of our business. How can it be that we would accept such a notion? Well, I'll tell you. We can sit patiently and listen to arguments that he is above the law because we have accepted the lie in our national soul that we are above God's law. That's why. His corruption. This corruption is a manifestation and reflection. The deep corruption that assaults us because we turn our backs on the truths that have been the source of our understanding and of our strength since the very beginning of this nation's life. It's a wonderful thing about America that in spite of everything, has always left me with a strong sense of allegiance and affection for this country. And I say in spite of everything because you shouldn't take it for granted that a black American would stand in front of an audience and say, oh, I love America. I wasn't born yesterday. I've done a lot of reading. I understand a great many very wicked things were done to black people in America. One of the most oppressive systems that was ever invented by the mind of man, fastened on the backs of my ancestors for several centuries in this country, tolerated by the majority of people, promoted by the laws. I can't ignore that. And it's enough to poison some people so they can't even think about this country without resentment. But what has always been the antidote to that for me was the understanding that right there at the beginning of this nation's life, something almost miraculous in political history occurred, something that I think we can only ascribe, as they ascribed it then, to the providence of our Almighty God. For all their sinfulness, for all their corruption, for all their willingness to be compromised, even in institutions of oppression, our founding generation nonetheless had an integrity and an honesty that apparently we lack. Because they were willing by the grace of God to acknowledge the truth by which their sins were being condemned. They were willing and did so in the Great Declaration to enshrine in the bedrock of this nation's life that truth which is a truth in human life and human relations. It goes beyond politics. It goes beyond countries. It goes beyond allegiances. And it goes to the very heart of all that is justice in human relations. Because they acknowledged in that great declaration that the worth and dignity and rights of each and every human being do not depend on human will and constitutions and laws. They are a consequence of the will of Almighty God. God is the foundation of justice. God is the foundation of rights. And you see, in every respect, that principle is the root of a right understanding of justice in human affairs. It is a reflection of another truth that transcends politics and justice itself and goes to the very heart of our human being. That truth that was stated at the beginning of our scriptures when in describing God's wondrous gift of our human life, it is said male and female he created them in the image created human. And that means that somewhere, even in the midst of this, our fallen nature, we nonetheless bear within us the reflection of our Almighty God. And don't you see, that means that what we are saying when we say we don't treat a human being as if they are a thing, we are saying, remember, that as I abuse this one and that one and the other one, I am treating God as if he were my creature. Abusing God's image as if it were my instrument. And it makes of injustice not just a wrong done to another human being, but a blasphemy. And that bedrock truth was a gift of providence to our nation's history. And it laid the foundations for enormous changes. It laid the foundations for the ultimate eradication of slavery. It laid the foundations for people to stand and lift their eyes from the ground and assert that yes, we have dignity and we must be respected in our rights, and the fruits of our work cannot be taken by the hand of oppression to be used and abused for the lust and profit of others. We demand without fear and in the conscience that God stands with us, justice of every human power. That is the great gift of that truth for us. And if we turn our back on it, as we do in the abortion doctrine, as we do if we ignore the abusive principle at the heart of this current scandal, then we're turning our back on the strong foundation of all our hopes, of all our institutions, of all our claim to dignity and human life. Now, I think that if we really understand this, we have a stronger sense of what has brought us together here tonight, and of that which I believe is truly the unifying, guiding principle of the Indiana Family Institute and of what I call moral conservatism in general. And that bedrock truth is very simple. Without God, there is no freedom. Without faith, there is no liberty. And therefore, we must stand for God, and we must act in faith if we are to preserve our freedom. And then the question becomes, what Americans often ask. I know. You can go through all of the bad stuff and the challenges and so forth, and everybody listens quite patiently as you have done. I really appreciate that. But somewhere in the back of all our minds, there is this American trait. I honestly believe that if we were all of us collectively suspended by a thread over the Grand Canyon, at the moment that it snapped, the question on every mind would be, what do we do? It's a wonderful trait. There's almost never a situation in which we're not going to stand up and say, okay, what do we do about this? Enough with the problem already. What's the solution? I actually think that the solution is pretty clear and has been for quite some time. And it's one that I think is striking us every day now, because the opposite is what is destroying us. First principle, insist on truth. Never act as if it's irrelevant. That, of course, means that in practical terms, any lie, whether it's about sex or whatever, told by our public officials, has to be taken very seriously. Step number one. Lies cannot be the basis of our public policy. And that, by the way, has implications for budget process and everything else. Can't lie in the way you keep the accounts and tell people that you have a budget surplus when you're really robbing the Social Security fund to create it. This is not good. Little things like that. Truth matters. Truth counts. It is a corollary of our respect for God, because God is truth. Lived a lie and you have turned your back on him. And therefore, we must reestablish what was right there in the beginning. We hold these truths to be self-evident. How can our freedom be based on truths if there is no truth? First principle, therefore, respect the truth. Care about it. Act as if it matters when we deal with the great issues that confront us. Second, of course, is understand that the moral priorities that gather us here tonight are right now the number one priorities of this nation's life. I have said it repeatedly over the course of the last several years. Now, folks are coming forward in the Republican Party. They were always there, I guess, on the Democrats. I tell them that this isn't true. Put it in the back of the bus. Worry about taxes and all these other sorts of things. Who are we kidding? I don't care how many people you send to the Congress of the United States who promise that they're going to cut your taxes and do the right thing. Do you know what the prerequisite is of fulfilling a promise? Moral integrity. If we have no people of moral integrity, we cannot trust to any of their promises. Therefore, before we can accept a promise about taxes, a promise about education, a promise about crime, or any other public policy, we must tend to the business of our moral corruption. You won't be able to solve a single problem this nation has if you can't find representatives with integrity to follow through on what they tell you. And that can't be done if the character has become so corrupted that a promise is just a means to manipulate. Therefore, moral character matters. and what goes on in our society to corrupt it, that also matters. And what is that? The corruption of our family life. The acceptance of a doctrine with respect to human sexual relations that disconnects it from family and responsibility. And that means that after truth matters and morality comes first, we must have the principle that we can't turn our back on those issues that represent the clearest assault on the moral foundations of family life. We can't turn our back on the abortion issue. We can't turn our back on the issue of homosexual marriages and privileges. We can't turn our back on the issue of lying and adultery. Those are public concerns. Family cannot survive if we allow rampantly to flourish that disrespect for sexual discipline and responsibility. And that becomes a litmus test. Yes, I'll use the term. When politicians come before you, they want to talk about everything under the sun, talk about the money, talk about the budget, but they won't talk about this. Then don't talk about them. Don't vote for them. Don't support them. It's very simple. Because if we lose our character, we lose our freedom. If we lose our discipline, our ability to govern our passions, to build strong families, then we can't take care of ourselves. We can't control our own actions, and they will have to be controlled. A weak character requires a strong government. And a weaker character still requires a government of totalitarian strength. Until finally, there is no freedom left at all. This is where we're headed if we don't care about these issues. But to care about them truly, we're going to have to regain control of our children's education. And that means putting as at the top of our agenda the belief that is represented by the Indiana Family Institute, get back control. And put it in the hands of the parents who are responsible for the children's education. It is an absolute prerequisite of our ability to reclaim self-government. These government schools are not just a disaster in terms of results. They are a threat to individual liberty. And some people will say, See, the principle we have to follow is pretty simple. Get back control of the schools, get back control of the money. Any money we spend, let it follow the choice of the parents. Take care of the problem. And final practical point, we need to get back control of our money. Now, how are we going to do that? See, I know that there are those who will come before you, they'll talk about this and that. Mostly they talk about tax cuts. I remind myself a little bit of Will Rogers, who said he'd never seen met a man he didn't like. I've never seen a tax cut I didn't like. I suppose it's just, but see, you have to understand with me, it's the principle that matters. I just think it's always a good thing to give people back control of their money. And the reason I think that is very simple. We have a system right now where the government preempts control of part of our dollar. Preempts it. That is to say, we earn it. And before we have anything to say about it, they come in and take it, don't they? How many people in here does that bother? Does that bother anybody here? See, because you've got to understand, if that really bothers you, that's not a matter of how much money you have left. That's a matter of how much you control. And when they come forward and they say, we'll give you a tax cut, we'll let you keep this, we'll let you keep that, we'll let you keep the other thing, they have still kept control. And so I'm not satisfied with it anymore. And I've watched as the Republican leaders have now gone down the Democrat road. They have managed to take the good issue of tax cuts and turn it into the bad, manipulative issue of tax bribes with which to try to buy off the middle class. Reject their tax bribes. They are a form of slavery just like welfare and jobs, handouts, and everything else. We don't need that kind of control. We need not control of 15% or 20%. We don't need a situation where they're coming to us all the time, and every time they say, we'll let you keep a little bit more of your money, we're supposed to go down on our knees and thank Master Government. Why? When are we going to remember? When are we going to recall that it is demeaning to thank somebody for letting you keep what you have earned in the sweat of your brow? It's our money. Don't thank them when they let us keep it. I am not content with the tax bribes and promises. You know what I want? I don't want to have a little bit more or a little bit less of my own money back in my pocket. I want control of 100 cents of every dollar I earn. That's what I demand. And I'll tell you something. Just by the by, it was also what the original Constitution of the United States guaranteed to us. That's right. Because the original Constitution of the country actually was written in such a way as to forbid the income tax. That's right. Oh, we live with it like it's always been there. You can't do anything about that. That's not true. For the first 120-odd years of this country's existence, it was funded by under a constitution that limited the federal government to tariffs, duties, and excise taxes. Taxes levied on transactions in the marketplace, open and above board. And I believe we'd better return to it if we want control of our money. We need to get to a situation, and it's not that easy, it's not that complicated to understand. You go out, you earn $100. You take it home. You sit down and you say, I'm going to put some of it in the bank. I'm going to spend some of it on clothes and food and the house. I'll spend a little more of it on education. And only when you've decided what you want to do with every last dollar does the government have any access to it at all in the transactions that you generate in the open marketplace. Why is that an advantage? It's an advantage because you control the decision, and it's an advantage because we do not have to surrender our privacy. See, it's the other aspect of the income tax system that we don't realize is enslaving. Blackstone wrote that a power over a man's resources is a power over his will. And how can you gain power over a man's resources? By knowing where every last cent of it comes from. That's why. So when we share all that information with the government, we're not just giving them our money. We're giving them potential control over every last cent and potential control over the lines of supply of our autonomy and independence. And we're not supposed to do this. We're like an army and we've let the enemy occupy our lines of supply. And little by little, we are being starved and put into a situation where we don't have the leeway left to support the institutions of our independence. So I think that's another part of the agenda of our liberty and our moral responsibility. Regain control of our resources. Now you'll notice that in all of that, I haven't said a single word about some government program. I love it. We always assume that the things to do are going to be some 12-step government program. That's because we've been brainwashed by the liberals. See? I have to tell you that I don't think this country's future depends on what the government does. I think the country's future depends on what we as a people do. If we can regain control of ourselves through the moral discipline that is grounded in faith, if we can regain control of our future by asserting once again our responsible role in the education of our children, if we can regain control of our economic law by insisting on a tax system that gives us the decision-making power over all our dollars. And I believe, without 50 government programs and this government, this and that, we will have returned ourselves to the strong foundations that will allow us to do what in the history of this nation the American people have truly always done. Made this country strong and great and kept it free. Not on the strength of our leaders, not on the strength of our government, but on the strength of our own responsibility and actions lived out with a sense of responsibility to our God. I believe that that is the vision of a decent land and a decent people that we are supposed to pass on to our posterity. Not the hopeless licentiousness of self-indulgence and government domination, but the hopeful sense that this is a nation dedicated to the better capacity, the better hope, the better destiny that God may very well have had in mind when first he said, let us make. In that sense, it is no accident that twice in this century we have beaten back the dark forces of evil and totalitarianism and tyranny and Holocaust and oppression that would have snuffed out the hope of that better destiny. But now, in our own quiet way, we would extinguish the candle with the lies of abortion and sexual irritation.